And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your pascally genial host, John Derbyshire, with news from far and wide. I'll explain that modifier down at the end of the broadcast. First, let's see what the carrier pigeons have brought into our little hideaway here in the sun-kissed Aegean. Big news story of the week was the Cleveland kidnappings. Three young women who went missing in 2002, 2003 and 2004 were discovered living as prisoners in a small two-story frame house in a working-class neighbourhood of that city. The house belonged to Ariel Castro, a 52-year-old bus driver of Puerto Rican origin. The women were aged 21, 17 and 14 at the time they were kidnapped. They're now 32, 27 and 23. The 27-year-old Amanda Berry had a child, apparently by Castro, and the child is now 6 years old. She was kept imprisoned in the house too. The women were real prisoners, kept in cells, first in the basement and then upstairs. They were secured with chains and not allowed to socialise with each other. They were raped, beaten and sometimes starved. There was mental torture too. Castro would leave a woman unchained and a door unlocked and pretend to leave the house. Then, when the woman got out, he'd pounce on her. He served them cakes on the anniversaries of their abductions. They were allowed out of the house just twice in all those years, to the backyard. What a piece of work. But the thing that's hard to figure out is, how did he get away with it? Castro's house is an ordinary, flimsy, working-class structure. You can kick your way through the wall of a place like that. A good piercing scream would be heard the length of the street. How did he do it? I guess we'll find out. This is a pretty pure specimen of what newspaper editors call a human interest story. That means it's hard to squeeze any large social or political conclusions out of it. Should we be more attentive to what our neighbours are up to? Some people might say so. Others, and I'm one of the others, while I completely approve of neighbours helping each other in a crisis or keeping an eye on the house when I'm away, and I enjoy occasional socialising on Labour Day and so on, I'd prefer we all mind our own business when not invited to share. Should police and other public services keep closer tabs on misfits like Castro? He was a known woman beater. Court papers show that his late common law wife, who left him in 1997, suffered, quote, several broken noses, broken ribs, busted teeth, a brain blood clot and dislocated shoulders, end quote. Again, not on my dollar. I'd hate for the USA to degenerate to the condition of modern Britain, where a child who falls and suffers a bruise is kept home from school until it heals, for fear the child protection stormtroopers will seize the kid and put him in a foster home. However, there was one related issue that called for comment from the thumbsuckers of opinion journalism, although to the best of my knowledge only one of them rose to the occasion. So here's that sidebar issue to the Cleveland abductions. The local ABC News affiliate interviewed Charles Ramsey, a neighbour of Mr. Castro's. Charles Ramsey, known around the neighbourhood as Chuck, washes dishes for a living. I pursued the same line of work for my first 6 months in the United States. So, naturally, I start off with warm feelings for this fellow member of the Suds and Mops fraternity. They only got warmer. In that 3-minute interview with the TV guy, Chuck spoke eloquently about how, while eating McDonald's fast food on his porch, he had heard Amanda Berry screaming. He'd gone to investigate, kicked out a panel of Castro's house door, and freed Berry and her daughter. Eloquently and also colourfully.
You got some big testicles to pull this off, bro.
Then Chuck, who is black, got a little bit too colourful.
I knew something was wrong when a little pretty white girl ran into a black man's arms. Something is wrong here. Dead giveaway.
Charles, thank you very much.
Dead giveaway.
Thank you very much for your time. And
either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she ran into a black man.
The TV reporter, who is white, didn't know whether to sneeze or wind his watch. He broke off the interview and scuttled out of there as fast as he could. The print media had a similar reaction. They all covered the interview with Chuck Ramsey, but to my knowledge, none of them, not even America's newspaper of record, the New York Post, none of them mentioned that part about the pretty white girl. Columnist Larry Elder, who is black, was the only big-name commentator to cover those remarks. He also covered the media silence on them. Quote, "News sometimes makes reporters feel uncomfortable. So what? Ramsey's comments reflect how the Good Samaritan felt, which makes it news. If Ramsey's other comments get reported, why not that one?" We all know why not. Because white Americans are deeply neurotic about race, much more so than black Americans. If you want honest talk about race, an articulate working class black person like Chuck Ramsey is your best bet. A white person is just going to cringe and blush, stutter and lie. An upper class black like Barack Obama is just going to be condescending or stick you with a guilt trip. Blacks are also more receptive to honest race talk than whites are. As Larry Elder notes, polls show that they're more willing to agree with negative statements about blacks as a group than whites are. A couple of times I have spoken to black audiences, expressing my views in a straightforward way, just as I do on Radio Derb and in my columns. I was always politely and thoughtfully received. If I'd said the same things to an audience of white liberals, I'd have been howled down. Well, thanks to Chuck Ramsey for reminding us of some home truths, and to Larry Elder for reminding us that he reminded us. I look forward with eager anticipation to the TV talk show that Chuck will soon be hosting, if TV producers have any eye at all for natural talent. Get out of dishwashing, Chuck, like I did. It ruins your hands. Who's going to control Derbyshire? Was the question on everybody's lips last week. Well, perhaps not everybody's. It was an issue in the actual English county of Derbyshire, though. Elections for county governments were held all over England on Thursday, May 2nd. The big winner was Nigel Farage's UKIP. That's UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which campaigns on the extraordinary platform that British affairs should be decided by British people. UKIP got 26% of the vote in these elections, up from 3% at the last general election 3 years ago. The number of county government seats they hold went up from 7 to 147. In a parliamentary special election held the same day, they placed second to Labour in a safe Labour seat, crushing the Tories and the Liberal Democrats. Britain's affairs at present are decided by globalist bureaucrats in the headquarters of the European Union. Immigration, to take one sore point, is out of the hands of British people or their elected representatives. It's decided by rules set by the EU. One consequence of this is that come next January 1st, Britain's borders will be wide open to immigrants from Romania and Bulgaria, two nations both dramatically poorer than Britain. Britain's main political parties are Globalist Liberal Labour, the Globalist Liberal Tories, and the Liberal Democrats, who are Globalist Liberal. British people have been voting for one or other of these parties based on vague historical sentiment or sheer habit. Memories that Labour was once the party of the working man, the Tories were once the party of capable, born-to-rule upper-class types like Churchill, and the Liberal Democrats were greener, more up-to-date, more technocratic and cool than boring old Labour and Tories. That is indeed how things once were. Nowadays, though, if there's any significant policy difference between the three parties, you need an electron microscope to see it. British people are waking up to that, and to the fact that the EU is little more than a banker's ramp, and that Britain governed itself pretty well for 1,000 years, while scoffing at the French as a nation of gun-shy dance instructors, at the Germans as obsessive compulsive eaters of rotted cabbage, at the Dutch as tulip fanciers in wooden shoes, and at the rest of the continent as garlic-breathed pederasts. If it worked for 1,000 years, they're saying, maybe it wasn't so bad, the occasional war notwithstanding. The immigration issue is more salient than ever. Millions of third world immigrants now live in Britain, and ethnic disaggregation is proceeding apace, as anyone not blinded by ideology would expect it to. A report published this week from a left-wing think tank over there says that nearly 5 million black and South Asian people, that's half the total, live in areas where white British are a minority. Just 10 years ago, the number was 1 million, a quarter of the then total. Quote from the head of that think tank, quote, "This has uncovered a really quite shocking level of concentration of the ethnic minority population, which means there is less opportunity for interaction with the white mainstream," end quote. Is there any limit to the stupidity of the multicultural left? Most human beings prefer to live among people like themselves. How hard is that to understand? The fantasy of utopian egalitarianism is stronger in its appeal, in its grip on the human mind, than any religion, it seems to me. I suppose sooner or later reality will assert itself, even upon their ideology-addled brains. The trouble is, by the time that happens, these fools will have turned several once proud, coherent nations into copies of Brazil, with the blacks down there, the browns over here, and the whites up on the hill. It's a shame. There's a faint hope that UKIP's election triumph might turn Britain back towards ethno-nationalism and sovereignty. More to the point for Americans, UKIP might inspire a similar movement in the USA. The globalist elites will do all they can to prevent this from happening, but as the British showed on May 2nd, the people still have a voice. Oh, Derbyshire? That went to Labour, unfortunately, leaving us with only the consolation of seeing Tory leader David Cameron, the most pathetically useless British leader since Ethelred the Unready, crying into his Veuve Clicquot. Some of my friends and listeners are worked up about the Benghazi business. I see their point, but I find it hard to engage with the issue. Just to remind you, last year, on September the 11th, a mob sacked the US mission in Benghazi, Libya, and killed our ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. At the time, the Obama administration said the attackers were a random mob, fired up because of an anti-Muslim video posted on YouTube by someone in California. We now know that it was a pre-planned Al-Qaeda operation, and it's probable that key names in the administration knew that at the time. This Wednesday in Washington, D.C., the House Oversight and Governmental Reform Committee opened hearings on the matter. Diplomatic and military folk who were on the spot have been testifying as to just how FUBAR the administration response was, and that everybody and his dog knew that this was a planned terrorist attack. Why aren't I engaging with this? Basically because it's all so deeply unsurprising. Barack Obama came to the White House having never administered anything in his life bigger than a playgroup in some Chicago slum. That he is a slipshod and inattentive administrator does not take my breath away. Hillary Clinton is, as Bill Sapphire told us 20 years ago, a congenital liar. Every word out of her mouth is a lie, including and the. As Radio Derb explained to you last October, all our troubles in Libya are the result of stupid humanitarian meddling by liberals who think they can fix the world with sanctimony and cash. These are liberal, world-improving fantasists let loose. I'm talking about you, Susan Rice, and you, Samantha Power, and yes, you, Hillary Clinton. These fools got four of our people killed with their pointless meddling. Then they lied about it. Would I like to see them breaking rocks in some federal pen? Of course I would. They are more symptoms, though, than problems in themselves. Washington's full of these saviours of humanity. They're silly heads bursting with grand schemes to turn foreigners into vegetarian Yankee feminists with gay rights bumper stickers on their hybrids. They are vain, incompetent, and ultimately unserious. 11-year-old kids with the keys to the family car. Unserious as they are, I can't take them seriously. I watch with scorn and disgust, and I shake my head and hope for better times. So, how are we getting on with the 2013 American Worker Displacement Bill, otherwise known as the Rubio-Schumer Amnesty and Cheap Labour Bill? Well, the thing went into committee this week, and the senators are chewing over it. We'll hear soon enough what they decide. In the meantime, there's been an outbreak of shrieking, clutching of skirts and jumping up on chairs from the guardians of our state religion. It's all related to the amnesty bill. Here's how. As we reported last week, the shirts of the bill's promoters are getting badly discoloured by flop sweat. The bill has not been an easy sell. Along with fanning himself desperately to get his body temperature down, Marco Rubio has been listening to the sucking, gurgling sound of his conservative support draining away. Meanwhile, stories about the bill, even in leftist newspapers like the New York Times and Washington Post, are drawing online comment threads angrily hostile. Then came more bad news. The Heritage Foundation, a neoconservative think tank that you'd expect to be happy about open borders and cheap labour, brought out a report calculating the cost of the amnesty provisions in the bill, if enacted, to US taxpayers. A minimum $6.3 trillion, they said, over 50 years. The newly legalized immigrants would cost $9.4 trillion in government benefits, but pay back only $3.1 trillion in taxes. The report was denounced all over by Chambers of Commerce Republican shills like Paul Ryan and Grover Norquist, and of course Marco Rubio, as well as by the usual suspects on the left. Administration stooges, software billionaires, George Soros's myriad front organisations, the race lobbies, and so on. It was serious scholarly work, though, and it made an impression. Something had to be done. The bill's supporters did some frantic digging, and they quickly struck gold. One of the heritage researchers who prepared the report was Jason Richwine, a statistician and a political analyst with a good background in math. It turns out that Richwine's PhD from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government was titled IQ and Immigration Policy. The thesis was read by three examiners, all eminent Harvard scholars, and approved, and Richwine got his PhD 4 years ago. In that thesis, Richwine does a thorough quantitative study of the average IQ of immigrant populations, broken down by the region they immigrated from, and quoting some well-known results on the different average IQs of different races. He then makes some policy suggestions, mainly that US immigration policy should favour smart immigrants over dumb ones, but for the sake of political acceptability, should cast the issue in terms of preference for skilled over unskilled immigrants, which was what the Heritage Cost Study had done. Obviously, Richwine was a horrible racist, and so, therefore, by association, was the Heritage Study. Just what the amnesty cheap labour lobbies needed. As Radio Derb goes to tape, the internet is ringing with denunciations of Jason Richwine as a sinister racist with Klan robes in his back closet and a Confederate flag on his pickup truck. It all reminds me of something, though I can't quite bring to mind what. In fact, Jason is a polite and charming young man. I've met him a couple of times. And his thesis, which I have read, it's on the internet, is an exemplary piece of quantitative scholarship. Well-structured, fully referenced, and carefully argued. The witch hunters are in fact having some trouble explaining how three eminent scholars, an economist, a sociologist, and a political scientist, at Harvard University, not formally known as a hotbed of extreme right radicalism, signed off on the thesis. The mystery deepens when you learn that the sociologist professor has a long paper trail as a liberal. In one of his early books, in fact, he called himself a socialist. Yet here these guys are, associating with, oh my God, a racist. What on earth is going on? The leftists just can't figure it out. It defies all their categories. Racists are snaggle-toothed hillbillies drinking liquor from a jar. What's one even doing at Harvard? Over at the Daily Kos website, some writer under the pseudonym Empty Vessel has called for the three professors to be, quote, held publicly accountable. He tells us he's written to the dean of the Kennedy School of Government asking, quote, why the school awarded Richwine a PhD and what they plan to do in the future to prevent it from happening again. This is Soviet stuff. As an enemy of the people myself, I hope Richwine stands tall and spits in the eyes of these two-bit commissars, as I do every chance I get. I also hope that the scholars who passed his thesis will stand up and make a vigorous defence of academic freedom and rational inquiry. If these things don't happen, we shall have edged a little way closer to the darkness. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Physicist Stephen Hawking is a hero of our time, and quite rightly so. He has set an extraordinarily high standard for coping with extreme disability. Coping with courage, good humour, and a dogged determination to live a useful life. In 1963, aged 21, he was diagnosed with motor neurone disease and given 2 years to live. That was 50 years ago. Not only is Hawking still with us, he's been married, divorced and remarried, produced 3 children, contributed to major advances in theoretical physics, and authored several best-selling books. For decades, he's had no motor functions other than the ability to twitch some facial muscles. A hero of our time, as I said. Hawking's also a left liberal in politics, though. He was recently invited to address an annual conference of international luminaries in Israel, along with Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and Michael Gorbachev. Hawking wrote to tell the organisers he decided not to go, quote, after receiving a number of emails from Palestinian academics. Well, it's his choice, I guess, though it's an odd one. For one thing, the head of the Palestine Chamber of Commerce, Munib al-Masri, will speak at the conference. If Palestinians aren't boycotting, what is the rationale for boycotting on behalf of Palestinians? Furthermore, the computer chip that controls Hawking's speech gadget, the one that turns twitches of his facial muscles into speech sounds, was designed by an Israeli team. The left has its own logic, I guess, but I'm sorry to see this genuine hero being sucked into it. Item, there was a lot of fuss this week about a libertarian group making a working plastic handgun by using a 3D printer. I was sceptical when I saw this. The pressures inside a gun at the moment of firing are tremendous. That's why gun metal is heavy, solid stuff. Can plastic really take that? Apparently it can, at least for a while. The news report said the gun fired off 6 .38 caliber rounds before becoming unusable. And I saw a TV demonstration of the firing. Ideally, you'd want a handgun to fire more than 6 rounds. On the other hand, in a lot of situations, 6 rounds is more than enough. I suppose Michael Bloomberg and Barack Obama and the congressional gun grabbers are having conniptions over this, but I'm fine with it. I'd be fine with the society of that Robert Heinlein novel, where everybody was armed all the time. On this, at least, I agree with the libertarians. An armed society is a polite society. The federal government seems to be taking a different line, and they're not letting that boring antique old constitution stand in their way. DefCAD, that's the website of those libertarians who published the printable gun software, DefCAD has been shut down, although not before 100,000 people had downloaded that software. A banner across the web page reads, quote, DefCAD files are being removed from public access at the request of the US Department of Defense Trade Controls. Until further notice, the United States government claims control of the information. End quote. How about that? Not to worry, though. I'm sure the federal government knows what's best for us. Item. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey has had something called lap band surgery to help control his weight. I never heard of this surgery. I thought a lap band was where you got the music for a lap dance from. Not so. I looked it up. LAP is short for laparoscopic, which relates to observing the inside of one's abdomen. The band is a wee belt that is tightened around the stomach so that less food can get in. It all sounds a bit icky, but I've sat across a table from Chris Christie and let me tell you, he's fat. He apparently plans to run for president in 2016, and he figures he'll be more appealing to voters if he's slimmer. That's probably right. And Christie's probably right in believing that he'll be healthier if he slims down. Still, I can't repress a twinge of sadness about it. Look at it this way. It's a loss of diversity. The world I grew up in had fat people, thin people, ectomorphs, mesomorphs, and endomorphs. Fat people were jovial and social. Thin people were irritable and solitary. Let me have around me men who are fat, says one of Shakespeare's characters. My best friend's a fat guy, and he's fun to be around. Isn't diversity supposed to be the supreme good? Not in this case, I guess. And speaking just for myself, Christie could slim down to Jimmy Stewart girth. I still wouldn't vote for him. The guy's an open borders gun grabber. Item. Finally, meet Kong Dongmei, 41 years old, of Peking, or Beijing, if you want to be up to date, or Beiping, if you want to flaunt your reactionary credentials. Anyway, please meet this lady. She's rich, seriously rich. Net worth around $800 million. That, someone has calculated, makes her the 242nd richest person in China. Okay, but why is this noteworthy? China's been popping out billionaires like the proverbial Pez dispenser for the past quarter century. Why is Miss Kung worth our attention? Well, because she's the granddaughter of Mao Zedong, that's why. In related news, we learn that Al Gore, who ran for president on the ticket of the Democratic Party, you know, the party of the little guy, is worth north of $200 million. He made $100 million just in January. Across the pond, there is Tony Blair, former Labour Party Prime Minister, charging $250,000 for a speech. Back in the great proletarian cultural revolution, the Chaikoms had a song titled Socialism is Good. Well, it sure is good to the ones running the show. There you have it, listeners. Another week older and deeper in debt. around $20 billion deeper in the case of the USA. Here in the sun-kissed Aegean, it's been a week of quiet reflection. Last Sunday was Easter Day by the Greek church reckoning. The main thing Greek Christians do at Easter, other than the prescribed religious observations, is they eat lamb. If you were raised as I was in the old English tradition, it's impossible to eat lamb at Easter without there coming to mind the surpassingly beautiful hymn, All in an April Evening. Yes, yes, I know April is long gone, but let's not be too punctilious here. Here's a snippet sung by the Glasgow Orpheus Choir, which was founded, incidentally, by Hugh Robertson, who composed this music for Catherine Hinkson's words. More from Radio Derb next week.